Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm your host, Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
I'm Matt Ganesda.
And today we have a very special guest joining us all the way from Texas, Mitch Edwards, cyber threat intelligence analyst for Intel 471. So, Mitch, today you're going to talk to us about the greatest cybersecurity threat to the United States, Russia.
Yeah, it's the Russians.
I knew it. Cold War never ended. But no, seriously, a lot of people, I think, do, a lot of Americans currently do think it's Russia that is the big, particularly cybersecurity threat. But what do you think about that?
So I spend a good bit of my waking hours arguing with people on social media, pretty much centered around that fact. You know, I studied Chinese in college, and you know, I've spent most of my waking hours after graduating, you know, studying the Chinese cyber threat. And I think there's enough evidence to say, especially in recent history, that while Russia poses a threat, I think China is more of a threat because we're focusing so much on Russia, among other reasons. I mean, the Chinese threat has grown in terms of their tactics and their sophistication, but they become that much more dangerous because, you know, all of America is focused on the Russian witch hunt, as it will.
So you spent years studying this, and what it amounts to is arguing with people on the internet. We're not so different, you and I.
No, we really aren't. I'm just kind of arguing it from a different angle, and, you know, you're doing it a lot better.
I don't know about that. We'll have to...
Well, you're more, Chris, instead of arguing with people, sort of like talking at them.
Oh, you don't know what I do in my free time.
Whatever floats your boat.
So I think a lot of people don't really have a good understanding of like the world of hacking. Most people probably just think of that, what was that, the name of the movie, that popular cyberpunk movie with Keanu Reeves, Johnny Mnemonic.
Wait, right. No. Point Break.
Point Break.
Yes, Point Break. That's the hacking movie.
Yeah.
They hack on surfboards.
Oh, man.
Point Break is where they rob banks wearing masks of dead presidents. Johnny Mnemonic is where he downloads... like memory into his head.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, no, he actually does.
All the Keanu Reeves cyber movies just blend together at some point.
I love that we have experts on the show and we go to movies. So this is the movie.
You know what blends in my mind is it's Keanu Reeves in Much Ado About Nothing.
Where he was doing that Howl hacking thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the hacking movie. Uh-huh. Much Ado About Nothing.
Forsooth, Beatrice.
Yeah.
The good thing is you can't derail a podcast if it starts off the rails.
Yes, this is. We got rid of the rails a long time ago. Other movie it reminds me of, because I got to get it in, the old Batman and Robin movie where Alfred dies in it, but it's okay because it turns out he downloaded his brain into a computer.
Wait, which one is that?
It's the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze.
Oh,
highly recommended.
Oh man,
no,
showing your age right now, Chris.
It's fresh.
I cannot.
It's still fresh
because
it's been kept on ice.
I think I stumbled upon it on the like TV or something a few months ago, and I couldn't make it like more than 15 minutes in.
Really?
It's so,
I guess we have different
terrible.
It's pretty bad. It's just pretty bad.
It's mostly ice puns from Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes.
Pretty much, yeah.
Let's kick some ice and talk about Chinese hacking of the United States.
Great segue.
Yes, we're smooth.
So,
with this.
Okay, back to the Keanu Reeves movie about hacking.
Yes. So how should your average person understand hacking? Are we going to be hacked while we're having a podcast right now?
So, yes, almost definitely. I mean, I think you've done enough of your public-facing research and your shows and all of that to land yourself on a list, and I think I've done enough to land myself on one. So, you know, this podcast is a welcome target, but you know, in terms of the average person, I think they need to have a healthy understanding of just kind of what kind of threat there is. And as a threat intelligence analyst, that's kind of what I focus on. You know, malware analysts are the ones who look at the bad stuff that the bad guys use, and threat intelligence analysts look at the bad guys themselves. So, you know, my focus on the Chinese threat has been less from a tooling and infrastructure perspective than it has been from a, you know, actor-based perspective. So who's actually doing, you know, the badness, you know, on the Chinese side, and how, you know, what can we do about it?
So who are the villains?
if you listen to the book released by or about the Mandiant story, apparently there are a bunch of 20-year-olds who are wearing leather jackets and, you know, smoking and watching adult film while they're working. Man,
they sound so cool.
Yeah, they're pretty cool. You know, the part that I loved about that story, and as a little bit of background, basically, you know, APT-1 was released back in like 2013-14. And that was detailing one of the bigger Chinese cyber groups.
That was the name of the Mandiant report.
Right. It was APT-1, which was like kind of a big deal because it was the first time that they had used that kind of naming convention. But it was talking about this big bad cyber group. And fast forward to this year, you know, some guy came out and said that, you know, he was watching the entire thing. And, you know, basically Mandiant had hacked the Chinese and was watching them through the webcams. And the funniest part was that he said all of the hackers who were based in Shanghai were wearing leather jackets. And, you know, I don't know how often you guys have gone to Shanghai, but wearing a leather jacket in the middle of the summer in Shanghai is doubtable at, you know, at the most. But nobody really paid attention to that part. It was just kind of the ridiculousness of the whole story.
Yeah, like the movie Drive, basically.
Right, right. Yeah.
Well, now you spent some time in Shanghai yourself.
Right. I spent about 3 months in Shanghai.
So did you get in good with Unit 61398?
We had coffee a couple of times, talked about some pretty significant differences between our countries, but we left on good terms. It was a good breakup.
Well, just a little background for people who maybe are not familiar with that. Just a second. I'm checking Unit 61398. I got that off the top of my head. That's really amazing. I'm really amazing. So that was a report by Mandiant in 2013, Mandiant being a cybersecurity like analyst firm. And they basically found this unit of hackers called Unit 61398, who were part of the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese Communist Party's military. And they had been one of the most severe cybersecurity threats in the world. And this was a pretty serious report that came out. It actually led to this group being a warrant was put out for the arrest, which was one of the first times something like that happened, right?
Right. And it set a precedent that we're still dealing with today. Mm. You know, we're trying to decide whether or not that's something we want to continue in the future because of our own hackers facing risk of, you know, having the, you know, that kind of action reciprocate. So
you mean the United States has hackers?
We've got like three or four. It's something we don't talk about much, but it's very few of them, like maybe three or four.
Well, but on a serious note, Mitch, because a lot of people say, well, okay, you know, China's hacking, but so is the U.S. What's the difference?
So that's tough, and that's a lot of the reason why I find myself arguing philosophy over actual technical stuff, because, you know, it has to do with we've got to believe in the American way and the American government doing the right thing. I find it relatively easy to believe that there's at least a comparative good between the two countries. You know, China has made a name for, you know, starving their people into, you know, obedience, while the U.S. has significant problems, especially in recent history. But we're not doing that. So there's at least a comparative good between the two countries. And I believe that if our government is hacking into foreign governments, there's got to be a hopefully ethical and legal, or not legal, but an ethical and a moral reason behind it. Whereas when the Chinese are doing it, it's not going to be for a good reason.
So who are some of the companies or people, or what do the Chinese target when they're hacking?
I think, actually, I want to say it was Hillary Clinton who said it. They're essentially hacking everything that's not nailed down. And I think that was a pretty good way to describe it. You know, we're seeing threats to everything from gaming companies to credit card companies to, obviously, you know, government entities, NGOs, and things like that. So, you know, it's really all across the board. And that's why I kind of try to stress that particular aspect, because Russia has relatively specific targeting. I mean, they're across the board as well. But, you know, their targeting is relatively specific to government and infrastructure and, you know, some pretty big financial institutions as well. But China, I mean, if it's on the internet, they're breaking into it.
So what does China need to be able to do to cross that threshold to be able to hack the things that are nailed down?
I mean, it's really a matter of time, unfortunately. At this point, their sophistication is growing, you know, exponentially. It seems like every month there's a new report that is indicative of, you know, their sophistication growing over time. and it's really only a matter of time until, you know, unfortunately, we have a specific reason to start focusing on China as the, you know, greatest cybersecurity threat over Russia, mm-hmm. which is why I'm trying to stress it before that happens.
Well, I think the sad part about the story is how seemingly ill-equipped the United States is to deal with it. In February of 2017, there was a report to the Secretary of Defense called the Task Force on Cyber Deterrence. And it says, the unfortunate reality is that at least for the next decade, the offensive cyber capabilities of our most capable adversaries are likely to far exceed the United States' ability to defend key critical infrastructures. Another report was talking about China and Russia, as well as others. But how do you feel about that? Where do you think the United States is in terms of being able to defend itself?
It's difficult to say. You know, part of it, there are a whole lot of, and you know, if we had about 12 more hours to talk, you know, I could go more into it, but there are a lot of philosophical discussions going on in the information security industry where we're trying to talk about the inherent kind of advantage that the attacker or the defender has against the other. And, mm-hmm. you know, the general idea was because, you know, it, quite frankly, it sells product. Saying that the attacker constantly has the upper hand is an easy thing to say. There's been a lot of pushback on that recently, but I think in the case of China versus the U.S., they do have an advantage because they don't have to play by a certain set of rules. Mm-hmm. The defenders have to play by the rules. China has been notorious in cheating in just about everything geopolitical, whether it be, you know, economic or trade measures, or it be in cyber. It all, you know, is exactly the same. So, you know, in terms of that battle, unfortunately, the one who plays dirty is going to be the one who wins, at least initially. I'm hoping that the U.S. can become more mature in their policy and in their infrastructure defense. But, you know, I kind of worry that it's going to end up being too little too late.
Hmm. Well, the Communist Party, in its own internal documents, has talked about how it's waging unrestricted warfare against the United States in cyber, hacking. For instance, is one of the techniques they use. So do you view this as a form of warfare?
It is, and it falls under a specific kind of general kind of warfare called information warfare. And unfortunately, China and Russia have been our biggest adversaries in that specific area. Hacking or cyber warfare falls under this, you know, domain of information warfare, which includes hacking as well as propaganda and, you know, just general kind of human intelligence and, you know, things like that. So all of this kind of falls under this umbrella. And unfortunately, that's kind of the biggest realm where you see the cheater being the winner in that case. You know, if you're willing to play dirty, you're going to have the advantage. And in terms of hacking, you've seen it where they've targeted OPM, which kind of seems like a cheat move. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, as kind of an aside to that, I was in Shanghai about 3 or 4 streets down from the building where that attack was traced from while it was going on.
And why didn't you do anything?
Well, I knocked on the door and left a microphone inside of a box of donuts, but I think they're gluten-free in that facility. So
oh, that's
it didn't work.
Gluten-free, right. Leather jackets. These guys, I got to meet them. They're great.
Gluten-free kind of diets has long been the adversary of intelligence operations. I mean, you can trace it back to the 80s, but we won't get in that.
It's top secret information.
Right.
Is there anything the average American should be aware of or do about the Chinese cybersecurity threat?
From the on-the-ground perspective, password protects everything. Two-factor authentication is an amazing thing, which basically means after you put in your password, you have another thing that you've got to do. So with most of my accounts, you know, not to give anything away because I guess that would defeat the purpose, but like it'll send a text or it'll send an email or something like that where you have to click a link or input a code or something like that. Most people have authentication, two-factor authentication on something, but at this point you should have it on everything. It just makes people's lives a little bit more difficult.
Such a pain. Can't you just like type in 12345 and like just be done with it?
Really, if you're the most secure you could possibly be, you're probably the least convenient. Like you're taking part in the least convenient practice humanly possible. So if it's less convenient for you, it's a lot less convenient for them.
So mildly inconvenience yourself to massively inconvenience Chinese military hackers.
Right, unless Google just lets them right in the back door, and in that case, it's not your fault.
Yeah, I think I'll stick to password one. It's too much.
That'll work. It's hiding in plain sight. If you use an obvious password, they're never going
There's
to
There's a Sherlock Holmes like that, right?
You're thinking of the purloined like letter, that, yeah. which is uh-huh. actually Auguste Dupin, which was an Edgar Allan Poe story.
Oh, Sherlock Holmes wasn't in that?
He predated Sherlock Holmes. He was the first detective, actually.
Oh, that's why I'm confusing it.
Yeah.
Wow, the world's first detective.
Hmm. I wish I were cultured.
Or Detective D. What?
Oh, yeah. I don't actually know when the Detective D novels were written.
Yeah, I was saying
But he's kind of like a judge. Like, is he?
But he was also a detective.
Okay.
Are you sure, Chris? Or you weren't just reading the fan fiction?
Wait, do you?
Speaking of 4chan.
So you don't know the fan fiction story. Okay, okay.
No, I don't think I do.
That's all? Then you don't need to know anything more.
Perfect. I'm sure I'll figure it out.
Well, if you do a search for Chris Chappell and
Harry Potter fan fiction.
Oh, God. No.
That is the exact response you should have.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I know all I need to know and more than I want to know.
Well, I think Shelley earlier had an interesting question, but what are they doing? Like, are they hacking, like stealing intelligence information? Are they stealing intellectual property? What are they going after?
Well, so in that they're hacking into everything that isn't nailed down, they're also stealing everything that isn't nailed down. So you see this in, you know, the fighter jet documents that they stole. You'll see this in other military, you know, technology that they've stolen that I'm sure we haven't seen pictures yet to prove. You know, they've targeted a whole lot of high-tech, you know, military industrial kind of companies like Lockheed Martin and a couple of other contractors. But they're also hacking into gaming companies. And the interesting point with that actually was a report that was released relatively recently in the last couple of weeks, I believe, where they hacked into gaming companies to steal technology that they could use to target activists. So, you know, there's kind of...
How do you target activists?
Yeah, what kind of technology is this?
So this is technology, and without going too far into it, it's essentially, it's called a code signing certificate. So with this kind of certificate, you use it to sign what would normally be, you know, like normal software. So these gaming companies would essentially use these certificates to sign their games and say, hey, this game came from us because we use this certificate. You know, this game came from us and we can prove it. So the importance of that comes into when you consider antivirus. Antivirus programs generally will look for certificates like that. And if they find a program that has just been downloaded that has a certificate, that's present that says it's a legitimate piece of software, it'll essentially whitelist it, which means it'll ignore it and say, okay, well, this is a good program. Well, the Chinese stole these certificates and were using it to sign malware, which means when they're targeting activists and that program is downloaded, the antivirus that's present on most of these activists, you know, devices is completely ignoring it. So, you know, you had this kind of operation going on at the same time as they were downloading, you know, cryptocurrency miners to make money themselves. And the general idea is that they're doing that to make a little bit of money on the side while they're targeting activists, which is a very Chinese thing to do.
What do you mean? What makes it a very Chinese thing to do?
We've just kind of noticed there's almost this cartoonishness about some of the attacks, you know, where, like, for example, on the cybercrime side, this is, you know, not necessarily, you know, state-sponsored, though there is a little bit of crossover, where on the kind of criminal side, they'll install this malware and they'll start mining cryptocurrency and stuff like that, but they'll leave messages around the computer saying you were hacked by this guy who has this QQ number, and they'll literally leave their calling card. I mean, you'll know exactly who it is, but they'll depend on the fact that nobody's going to do anything about it, you know. So there's kind of like this mischievous side where, you know, yeah, they're nation state hackers, like you saw with you know, one of the hackers in APT1, his name was Wang Dong. And he went by Ugly Gorilla. And we knew that because he left his name and all of the source code that he wrote, you know, all of the malware that he wrote had his calling card in it. You know, so there's this kind of mischievous side where they're saying, you know, we know that you know what we're doing, but you can't do anything about it. So we're going to keep leaving our calling card just kind of to demoralize us.
Well, it sounds like a Batman villain. You know how like the Joker leaves a playing card?
Right. I mean, it sounds like something right out of a cartoon. If they weren't stealing, you know, military secrets.
A leather jacket wearing, gluten-free, ugly gorilla leaving his name card everywhere. This is a hit.
We're going to have a movie.
You can move into comics. Yeah. I'm telling you. Yeah. You can move into comics or a movie.
Yeah. But the scope of this is really stunning. Also, we mentioned the OPM hack earlier, and that affected 21.5 million Americans. And,
So let me break in there for just one moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't mean this to kind of try to sell the, you know, just kind of destruction that was wrought because of this, but it's affecting us still. Mm-hmm. If, you know, you have any experience, you know, dealing with people that have tried to go into the intelligence community in the last couple of years, it's almost impossible. The time that it takes to apply for a clearance has almost doubled or more since the OPM hack, because they've basically been scrambling trying to cover their tracks and make sure that, you know, all of their bases are covered. So it set them back, you know, it was already a long enough process, but it set them back to where, yes, it affected these, you know, 20 million people, but it's still affecting people to this day. Anybody who's trying to apply for a clearance is being affected because of this.
Wow. I forget who it was I was talking to, but they mentioned that one of the effects of that is the Chinese Communist Party was able to see, you know, which Americans had what kind of security level clearance and which people had debts or which people had these various levers that they could use to make people essentially spy on the United right. States for the Communist Party. So it definitely was a huge deal.
Right. I mean, they were looking for dirt, and they took all the data that they possibly could. And I'm assuming as soon as they stopped, you know, siphoning data off, they started analyzing it and looking for dirt that they could use.
I was wondering if you could weigh in on this. I remember a guy named Casey Flemings of Black Ops. It's like securities.
Black Ops Partners was the name of his security firm.
And one thing he said was that Chinese intellectual property theft is costing the U.S. $5 trillion a year when you factor in the net economic value over the course of 10 years. Which is an insanely high number, but what he was saying is where he's getting that information from is he works privately with companies that do not want it to become public that they've been hacked because it could tank their stock value or could get the CEO in trouble. How much of this is just going underreported?
I mean, I think the majority of it is underreported.
Majority.
And that's, I would honestly say, you know, it's kind of an iceberg problem where we're all freaking out about, you know, the big breaches that we see in the news. But coming from the perspective that, you know, I've gotten to watch these things happen from, you know, the beginning to the end, basically from initial breach to when the card data is on sale, for example, or when finally the company is forced to, you know, admit that they were breached, I would say that because the policy that the U.S. has is not mature enough to deal with breach notification, I think that the majority of it is underreported. And when you look at intellectual property theft specifically, you don't want to right off the bat admit that your intellectual property was stolen, because the first thing a smart consumer is going to do is wait for the Chinese to start selling it for cheaper.
Mm.
So there's a lot of advantage to not reporting on it. And, you know, I'm not saying that that's what you should do. It's a bad precedent to set, but I almost understand it from that perspective. I mean, you've got to pay the bills. You've got to keep, you know, the food on the table. And when these companies are losing this amount of money already and just right off the bat with these, you know, intellectual property theft, you know, it's, You've got to kind of understand it from their perspective. And when you think about it also in terms of just business intelligence that they're stealing, you know, they're stealing essentially the internal documents that dictate how they're going to trade, for example, or what their acquisition value is or something like that. That's something that you really can't tell that you've been hacked. You know, when they find out that kind of internal information from a company, and they use it in the immediate future and to negotiate business deals, you may not ever know that that information was stolen. So it's a scary thing to really think about, you know, that it's both being underreported and, you know, underinvestigated.
You said earlier that one of the reasons that these Chinese hackers were leaving their name cards was that they were kind of taunting He was like, you can't do anything about it. Is there anything that the companies who have been hacked can do?
There is, to a point. You know, the kind of goal within, you know, this kind of realm is to make it as expensive as humanly possible for these hackers to get away with it. So, you know, for example, if I defend my network to the utmost extent and just throw money at it and throw money at it and throw money at it, the hope is that it's going to take them so long to actually infiltrate my network, and it's going to take them so much work that they're either going to give up, or that whatever they gain from that infiltration isn't going to be worth what they spent for it. So that's, from kind of a soft power point of view, that's one way that you can do it. You can make sure that when you do get breached, you make it as expensive as humanly possible for them to actually profit off of it. The other side is a lot more controversial. You know, you can start seeing private companies hacking back against the Chinese. And that's an incredibly, you know, controversial subject right now. I've talked about it at length on both blogs and podcasts, where nobody can really decide where they stand on it. You know, the majority of people don't want to see the Wild West break out between China and, you know, U.S. private companies. But, you know, again, it's kind of from the perspective of, you know, the defender. You're automatically at a disadvantage if you're playing by the rules and they're not.
Why would, what would be the advantages of the private companies hacking back versus the United States government doing something?
Well, so, you know, right now it's difficult to say because we haven't seen it, or at least we don't know that we've seen it. You know, we can obviously assume that the U.S. government is taking offensive measures against the Chinese. I think, you know, everybody is at least, you know, complicitly aware of that. But in terms of private companies, they know very, you know, they're the first ones to know how their network was breached and what was stolen. And they know the value of it, and they can oftentimes know where the data is stored after it's been stolen. So the idea is to go back, delete all remnants of the data that was stolen, and if, you know, you're an extremely pacifist person, you say you pull out, and that is the last that you deal with that network. And that's considered, you know, that's kind of like the really easy to sell version of hacking back. The other idea is you go on the offensive, you walk in, you delete everything that you can find, and you completely destroy their network. And you gather as much intelligence on the way out as you possibly can. You know, that's the other side of it. So you can kind of see why this would be controversial. That's obviously way outside of, you know, a typical private company's area of operations. And most people are only comfortable with a government or military entity doing, you know, offensive, you know, computer network operations. So it's tough.
Speaking of government or military entities, how much of the Chinese hacking of the U.S. is done by the Chinese Communist Party's military versus private actors? And are there really any fully private actors at all?
So that's kind of, you know, I know that obviously anybody, you know, that you guys are dealing with knows pretty, you know, clearly that there's a very, very, very kind of small line between the private and public industries in China. I would kind of argue that it barely exists at all. You know, there's some kind of, you know, private corporation separation, you know, of those corporations and state. But in terms of, you know, the cyber warfare that we're seeing, there's not much separation between the two. You know, I would imagine that the majority of the big hacks that we're hearing about, especially APT-1, was traced back to an actual military entity. But a lot of the ones that we're dealing with right now basically sit on that line between private and public. You know, a lot of the hacktivists that I traced, you know, through my research in the last couple of years, they started off as private citizens. They were just individuals. And through their history, you know, basically as hacktivists, you know, hacking for, you know, their country, they were essentially a cyber militia at that point. And they were hired by private companies that ended up being public entities and now are assumably part of, you know, the Chinese PLA. And, you know, that's kind of like an illustration of how, you know, narrow that line is between the two. You know, you've got so much crossover that, you know, I would almost argue that it doesn't exist. The border between the two just doesn't exist.
Well, so for somebody listening who hears that, you know, this is essentially the Chinese military aggressively waging cyber warfare on the United States, what is the problem with private companies hacking back?
you've got to wonder where the line is. Attribution is one of the most difficult and nigh on impossible games in cyber, and that's deciding, you know, once you realize that there's been attack, that's deciding who did it. And, you know, that's long been China's excuse for getting away with this stuff, is they say, well, oh, attribution is so difficult, so you can't honestly say that it was us. They did that after APT1, and the APT1 report was a ton of very specific information that you can objectively look at and say there's no arguing against this. But still, China said, well, you know, they could be messing with the data to make it look like the Chinese, it could be a false flag attack, all of this. So that kind of excuse is why a lot of people don't want private companies taking part in, you know, offensive cyber measures, because what happens if you get it wrong? If you decide that you're going to attack the Chinese PLA and it was actually the Russians, and now you've got, you know, you've added some fuel to the fire that is keeping the conflict between the US and China boiling. You know, we don't want World War III to happen ever, but we definitely don't want it to be Booz Allen Hamilton who starts it.
Well, so are there any laws in place currently that would prevent a private company from taking matters into their own hands?
Well, every hacker's favorite law, the CFAA, technically covers that. It covers international hacking as well as, you know, probably a couple of other sub-laws, but that would be the big one. If a private company were caught, you know, hacking back, that would, I would assume that they would be charged under the CFAA and probably trade violations as well, depending on how they use the data. But, you know, that's kind of the blanket law, that you can charge anything that touches a computer network with the CFAA.
So this goes back to what you were saying before about how the defenders, if they're playing by the rules, are actually at a disadvantage.
Right, because, you know, everybody wants to defend their network. A lot of people probably want to do so with offensive measures, but nobody wants to be the one who does jail time for it.
And so you mentioned earlier that one of the defenses these private companies do is they try and make it very expensive. They put a lot of money into securing their systems. But then you hear stories about, for example, U.S. defense contractors who fail to even use a password.
Right. And that's been China's kind of go-to, you know, and that's why they're arguably winning, is because they're using the cheapest measures humanly possible to infiltrate these networks. I mean, you know, we've seen reports where they're using 0 days, which are, unreported vulnerabilities in a system. And that just means that they targeted a vulnerability in a technology that we didn't know about yet. And we've seen that happen. And that's considered the most advanced, you know, kind of threat that you could be facing as a, you know, an entity that uses these, you know, kind of high tech measures. But a lot of times it's somebody decided to put something on the open internet that they shouldn't have. They decided not to use a password, or they decided to click too many emails. You know, and if they're spending 30 seconds to draft up an email and put a bad thing in it, and we're falling for that, there's no point in blowing, you know, this high tech expensive stuff.
Well, we actually have a clip of Admiral Philip Davidson talking about Chinese hacking at a recent Senate Armed Services Committee. Let's play that.
I believe that they are stealing technology in just about every domain and trying to use it to their advantage.
And what's the means that they use to steal that technology?
One of the main concerns that we have, sir, is cyber and penetration of the dot-com networks, exploiting technology from our defense contractors in some instances.
So why aren't these defense contractors great at cybersecurity as well?
It's two sides. So, you know, kind of the cybersecurity industry's favorite saying is, you know, hindsight's 20/20. A lot of this stuff seems really obvious in hindsight,
like why did you not use a password? Yeah.
Right. Now that, I don't know the particulars behind that situation. I don't feel like that should ever be excusable, but, you know, again, hindsight's 20/20. With a lot of this stuff, you think, well, you know, they were probably, like, for example, one of the problems that, you know, the industry's been dealing with as a whole, and, you know, the Chinese have exploited it in the past before, is that all of a sudden data is just online, and it's pretty freely accessible, and it's very sensitive data. And, you know, in hindsight, you say, why in the world was that put online? But a lot of times it was a server that was put up to test, and they were trying to make sure that it works, and they didn't have anything on it, so they didn't figure there was any point in, you know, securing it. but they never took it down. And then they started putting, you know, sensitive stuff on it. Mm. And that seems like an honest mistake. But in hindsight, it's like, why did you just put a ton of customer information online?
That, yeah, that reminds me of the big hack of U.S. South Korean a military base recently, where some technician had connected the military base's intranet to the internet, and then hackers were able to get in because that connection was left in place for a year accidentally.
And when you realize that it's a matter of forgetting to unplug one thing, and a lot of times it's a matter of forgetting to type in one or two letters and a command, that's when you kind of start to realize how easy it is to make a very serious mistake.
So it seems like people are the problem here.
People will always be the problem. You know, whether it's clicking phishing links or plugging in things that they shouldn't or typing in commands they shouldn't, people will always be the problem, regardless of how high tech we get.
So considering the information warfare that the Chinese Communist Party is waging on the United States, how concerned should we be that Chinese leader Xi Jinping has his Made in China 2025 plan, where, amongst other things, China is going to be a tech leader?
Well, you've got to look at what makes that easier. And, you know, cyber warfare falls pretty easily within that framework, where if you're stealing intellectual property, and the turnaround time from stealing the intellectual property to putting it in production is very, very fast for China. You know, we're seeing, like, for example, the jet documents they stole. You know, they stole the blueprints for, I think it was F-35. Mm-hmm. And the turnaround time to that being a Chinese jet was relatively quick when you consider the, you know, the technical feasibility of that kind of program. But, you know, when you think about the Made in China 2025 kind of plan, that's made a whole lot easier when you're stealing everything from the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, when you're not having to put near as much work into it, near as much money or an investment, you know, it's very easy to blow up in the tech scene when you don't have to innovate. Mm-hmm.
Do you know about the technology transfer centers they have?
I'm vaguely familiar with that. It's not really in my kind of area of research, though.
Oh. Well, it's something that they have actually written up in their economic plan, so it's very out in the open. But essentially, it's where they have, like, this is how they were able to do it so fast with the F-35. It's a streamlined system where Chinese hackers steal some piece of intellectual property. It's given to these technology transfer centers, which then reverse engineer that technology and then give it to Chinese companies.
Right. And we've actually, there's a pretty close parallel to that in a report that I read recently. And I wish I could remember what company put it out, because it was very interesting, where they saw, you know, the post-exploitation stage, which means after they've already broken into the network, that is the area that has confused U.S. researchers the most when facing these kind of, you know, breaches, where we're thinking they're stealing intellectual property, but the average hacker is not going to know what to look for. And we're seeing that in a lot of these cases, they'll break into the network and there will be a kind of lull time where we won't see any kind of activity, and then they'll pop back on and immediately know what to steal. And the idea is, you know, what we're assuming is that after they, you know, infiltrate the network, they do some initial reconnaissance, find out what's on the network, and then an expert in whatever field that, you know, the industry that they've breached in, you know, they'll come in and say, this is exactly what we need. And they'll go in, take it all, and, you know, pop right back out.
Leaving their calling card behind.
Right.
Well, so
the ugly gorilla calling card.
Yeah, it's almost like the industries that want to steal the data are almost like outsourcing.
Right.
With these hackers. Like hiring hacker to just take the specific things.
It's like, you know, in the case of the windmill company, you know, if I were to hack into a Chinese windmill company, I would not know what to steal. I don't know what technical blueprints look like. I don't know how a windmill works. But I do know that I can go call the state-sponsored or state, you know, past kind of, you know, windmill company. And they'll come over and say, hey, we need this, this, and this in order to build, you know, a windmill for, you know, super cheap and subvert the Chinese market. It's the same exact thing on the Chinese side. You know, they're calling industry experts in, which is another example of how that line is blurred, where, you know, a lot of times we're assuming that the private industry experts are tasking the Chinese military and saying, this is what we need in order to do what we want to do.
China currently is trying to make a lot of breakthroughs in quantum computing. How will that affect anything?
So that's hard. Quantum computing could be the next big breakthrough in just about everything, from cancer research to Alzheimer's research to breaking passwords that can be used to hack into the Pentagon's network. You know, that's the kind of range that we're talking about. It can be used for incredible good. It can be used for, you know, a lot of really cool research purposes, but it can also be used for, you know, essentially just very resource intensive, you know, kind of projects. So cracking passwords that could be 20 or 30 characters long.
Wow.
Or, you know, something like that, you know, that would normally take a normal computer literally millions of years. A quantum computer can do it a lot faster. So that's one area, one relatively simple area of, you know, kind of worry from us. But just from an economic standpoint, you know, the first person that perfects quantum computing is going to be the first person that perfects a lot of things. And that's what we're worried about, AI research in particular.
When the machines figure out they can finally get rid of the people.
Well, I mean, like I said, humans will always be the problem until there are no more humans. So, you know, whoever perfects the AI gets to, you know, buddy up to them a lot quicker than we do.
I'm having second thoughts about putting this podcast on the internet.
I'm giving people ideas now.
Oh, you're right. I'm curious, what is the Trump administration doing that is similar or different to the Obama administration?
So one thing that I particularly disagreed with the Obama administration on was the indictment of the Chinese hackers. I think that
Really?
That was an incredibly dangerous precedent to set.
Mm.
For the reasons that I mentioned before, you know, indicting another country's hackers, knowing that you're probably not ever going to get your hands on them, sets a precedent for China to do the exact same thing to the U.S. hackers, or, you know, made just the suspected U.S. hackers further on down the line. And it sets the precedent for, you know, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and everybody else. But it was kind of weird because while I have a problem with that, I also have a problem with Obama being too soft on, you know, the Chinese cyber espionage. His agreement with Xi, I think data shows that it worked.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of think that the resurgence of the Chinese state-sponsored hacking largely is because they know that Obama probably wouldn't have done anything about it if they were caught then.
And just background for people who may not know, the agreement between Obama and Xi Jinping was basically about kind of commercial hacking, that they, on the surface, agreed not to do that. But then what you saw after that was China coming up with a bunch of laws that essentially, they made laws to get around that fact and just required companies going to China to hand over their intellectual property, their source code data, as part of doing business in China or having to work with a Chinese, local Chinese company. So they found ways around that agreement that essentially did the same thing.
Well, and I think, you know, kind of as a disclaimer to what I said, I think that Obama was put in a very tough position with what he was faced with Chinese hacking.
Mm-hmm.
Trump in particular, I think he's focusing too much on rhetoric, whereas Obama was a little bit quieter about it. Trump is focusing a lot more on rhetoric, and that can work a lot with the Chinese, but I don't think it's going to work in this particular circumstance.
Mm.
Not necessarily because of state-sponsored attacks, but because of hacktivist attacks.
Mm. So where that line between state-backed hackers becomes a bit blurred, you mean?
Right. You know, if the Chinese government says that I can't hack the U.S. at work, then I'll just wait until I get home and do it as part of a patriotic nationalist Chinese hacker militia or what have you.
So what would you like to see the U.S. government do?
I would like to see a little bit more cultural awareness and honesty. I think we need to be honest with both the American public and with the Chinese that we know that intellectual property theft is part of their strategic plan. And I think we need to have a hard line discussion about whether or not that kind of, you know, that kind of rhetoric needs to stand. Do we need to allow China to completely ignore, you know, what the U.S. is saying and basically depend on another president coming in 4 years and then being able to manipulate the rules after that? Because that's essentially what happened. Obama, you know, was able to stop the, you know, intellectual property theft to a point, but as soon as Trump walked in, you know, it began almost on cue.
Mm.
You know, so China, because they've installed their dictator in chief now, they don't have to worry about the 4-year turnover rate.
Hey, he's elected by
right,
the
elected
People's
by the
Congress.
He's elected by the people he appointed, which is very convenient for him. But, you know, I think we need to start being more honest about the kind of strategic goals that China has. That needs to be something on the forefront of people's minds, you know, when we're dealing with the Chinese, is that it's their strategic goal to subvert our economy and to subvert our culture.
It is warfare.
And, right, it is warfare. And, you know, it doesn't have to be missiles pointed in any direction. It can be a much more cold and quiet form of warfare, but it is warfare.
Well, I've certainly been encouraged by, particularly in the past couple of months, the U.S. intelligence services speaking out very clearly about the threat the Chinese Communist Party poses. The CIA recently going so far to say that we're in another Cold War.
And I think that the Cold War kind of vocabulary is a good one to push, but we need to be careful with it because it's a different kind of Cold War. This isn't the Cold War where, you know, we've got missiles pointed in two different directions. This is the kind of Cold War where it's hot, but the average person doesn't know that. Hmm. You know, in terms of cyber warfare, I mean, it's ongoing. We've got offensive operations and defensive operations on both sides. Everybody, you know, acknowledges that. And that makes it a hot war. It's only cold because the average person doesn't ever see the effects of it.
Yeah.
And that's good. You know, hopefully it will stay cold to the average, you know, person, and, you know, people in the industry can deal with it on their own as a hot war. But, mm-hmm. you know, we just kind of need to be careful because, you know, it sounds really sexy to say that we're in another Cold War, but it's a very different kind of war that we're fighting right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's a very different psychological impact when you're having American citizens building bomb shelters in their backyard versus what do you do now?
Well, we built bomb shelters during the Cold War, but we can't password protect our, you know, our contractors.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to see to say we're in the Cold War. Mm. It's complicated.
Oh, why does it have to be complicated?
Oh, tell me about it. I wish it could all be simple, like when we had nukes pointing our direction.
Ah, the good old
days. The good
days.
Old days, yeah.
The good old days, if I could go back.
Well, knowing
to before I was born.
Yeah. Well, knowing that it doesn't end in global nuclear annihilation, it does seem simpler.
Well, we hope.
Well, I guess, you know, I guess that card is still on the table.
Right. You know, and the idea of it being a Cold War in cyber doesn't mean it couldn't go cold or hot in any other, you know, direction. That's just kind of one medium that we're fighting over right now and that we hope doesn't spill over into others.
Mm. It's too bad China controls Hollywood. Otherwise, there'd be some great movies about this.
Oh, there'd be some amazing movies. I mean, Transformers could have been an awesome movie if, you know, China didn't take control of it.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Hollywood phenomena that is, you know, Transformers movies.
Yeah, they're robots, but they're in disguise. They're more than meet the eye.
Are we talking about Shia LaBeouf or the actual Transformers? I can't tell which robot you're talking about.
I think with Shia LaBeouf, he's exactly what meets the eye.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you look at him, you're like, yep, that's definitely Shia LaBeouf.
This is incredibly off topic, but have you heard that song? Like, I think it's called "Actual Cannibal," Shia LaBeouf.
Yes, that's and it's amazing. Hysterical. It's the only good thing to happen from Shia LaBeouf,
especially his like bizarre Citizen Kane style clap at the end.
Yeah, and it's just like, yeah, I almost feel like he had more of a hand in that movie than people are led on.
Yeah,
but it's. Man, it was an artistic masterpiece.
Did you hear how? Oh, I'm probably not going to explain the story well, but like he was like, how did he do it? Oh, this is going to be a bad story. I'll probably cut it, but it's an interesting story that I'll just tell you. He was like making these kind of videos, like antagonizing certain people. I don't really know, but the point is like he would like hoist up like a flag somewhere, and people would come and take it down, and it got to the point where he was like. He made like one of these videos in a field in the middle of nowhere, like with no identifying features around him, and like he put up some flag or something. This is really not a well-told story, but the point is, like, these people on the internet like watch the video. It was kind of a partly cloudy night, so you could see this like some stars in the sky, and people triangulated based on that where he was. And
oh, I love people.
So that's a cool story that you should probably look up.
Can we
up.
Get those people to work on cybersecurity?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That'd be great. Just geolocate all of the hackers so we can't do anything about it still because diplomatic immunity and all of that fun stuff. But, you know, it'd be cool.
We need to harness the power of 4chan.
No, 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 no,
no. No one man should have all that power.
Like nuclear energy. It's like it's too much power for humans to have. It'll go wrong.
Yeah, and then you end up with a radiation sickness afterwards.
And now we're into Fallout, the game series.
No, you might end up president if you harness the power of 4chan.
I don't think he specifically tried to harness the power of 4chan.
It's like the Ark of the Covenant.
I mean, I'm not sure he knows what 4chan is. Yeah.
That quote's going to stick with me. 4chan is like the Ark of the Covenant.
Wait, whose face is melting in the scenario, though? Because in the original, it was the Nazis' faces that melted. But if 4chan is the Covenant...
Or is 4chan the Nazis?
Oh man, this analogy is eating itself.
We're diving deep.
So the lesson is, like, if you want to not have your face melted by 4chan, you have to do what Indiana Jones did and just close your eyes and not pay any attention to it.
Right. Just don't pay attention to 4chan. If you get any lesson from this podcast about Chinese cybersecurity, know that you shouldn't pay attention to 4chan.
Unless we have a lot of fans on 4chan, in which case I love you. Help us take over the world.
Right.
Was that, like, perfect ending to this podcast?
That was probably the best segue that you could possibly have had.
And on that note, well, thank you again for joining us, Mitch. If people want to learn more about you and what you're doing, what can they do?
So this sounds like a joke, but the vast majority of information security research is done on Twitter. So you can follow me on Twitter at Viking_SEC. Don't ask. There's a story there, but you probably don't want to spend too much time asking. You can also follow me on Medium, which is a blogging platform. My username on Medium is TheCTIGUY, the CTI guy. So you can follow me on either of those. I do a podcast on Twitch as well. Same username is on Twitter, Viking_SEC. So I do that every week, and you can follow my podcast there as well.
Hey, Mitch. What's the Viking story?
The Viking story is I really liked the TV show Vikings and got entirely too into it and then named my dog after one of the characters. So now I'm Viking everything.
Which character, though?
Bjorn.
Wait, which one was Bjorn?
Bjorn was Ragnar's son, Bjorn Ironsides.
Ah, right, okay. I watched the first couple seasons of that.
It's just brutal.
On the so-called History Channel.
The History / Drama Channel.
Yeah.
/ aliens.
Yeah, and aliens.
The only scene of that show I've seen, it's like, I think somebody's about to like have his head chopped off at like an executioner thing, and the guy's just like, ask somebody, please hold my beard so it doesn't...
Yeah, hold my hair. Yeah.
Yeah, and like as the axe is coming down, he pulls back, and so the guy gets his hands chopped off.
It's just a brutal show. And they just all start, like the Viking starts laughing, the whole crowd is like throwing up in the background. Oh, it was amazing. But you
Shelley
just learned a lot about my personality.
In horror right now. You should see the look on her face. Well,
they can't because it's a podcast.
Thank goodness. That sounded kind of insulting.
Ooh, yeah, it did, didn't it?
I did not mean it that way. So great. Be sure to check those things out. And thanks for listening to China Unscripted. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
I'm Matt Ganeshta.
See you next time. Talk to you next time. I gotta get that right.